Pace's update?
Yes.
And?
No, we're waiting. Reed Sato is going to come a little bit later.
Okay, so we're going to start.
Item 12.
Item 12, okay.
Is that for public forum? Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we did 17, we did 7. We're now ready to go to item number 12, which is the TMDL for fecal coliform in the Lower Salinas River watershed. Mr. Briggs.
Pete's not here. Okay, I think we're going to have to shuffle again.
Okay, and Reed is not here. And we can go to the EO's report.
Is that the next one?
Yep.
Let's see, how about, you want to go to the EO report?
That would be the only other thing we can do.
Well, reports by board members. Oh, really? I missed it. Okay, we can go to the...
I thought we did 17.
Okay, I missed it.
Yeah.
It was just too fast for me.
Our vice chair said we did 17.
Yes, we
okay.
did.
Okay.
And then the board members.
Okay.
All right, on the executive officer's report, item 18, we have our water quality certifications information item. And then on page 3, as the board requested at the last meeting, we have an update on the stormwater compliance status for the Monterey Regional Stormwater Management Program. We, just to remind the board, we did indicate at the last meeting that we had planned to have a complete report at our May meeting, and we still intend to do that. However, we said we would provide whatever information we could put together in the short time between the last meeting and when the agenda had to be prepared for this meeting. So we've done that, which actually turns out to be quite a bit of information. And we did include the joint audit. There was a joint audit with us and EPA of the Monterey Regional Municipal Stormwater Sewer System compliance status. So we have that report. And we did issue a notice of violation for the many violations that we've categorized here in this report. Let's see, on page 2, or pardon me, it's page 4 of the EO report, but the second page of this report, right in the middle of the page, it says that that in February we had asked the county for what the story was on their ordinance adoption progress, because they were clearly way behind in meeting the timeline for that. And at that time we were told the county's goal was to adopt the ordinance as soon as possible, but they had scheduled the first read of the ordinance for March 2nd, Monterey County Board of Supervisors meeting. And of course, we are now past that date. And our understanding, Lisa McCann told me this morning, is that you were able to get verification that, in fact, they did have that on the supervisor's agenda. And was they, pardon me? Oh, they did adopt it. Okay. So that's a bit of an update to that update. And are there any questions at this time on the information we provided? Like I said, we're going to have more of an update in May.
What generated staff's audit of the Monterey Regional Swamp?
I don't know what the genesis of that was. There are periodic audits with EPA on various programs, for example, pretreatment audits, just as a matter of course, just like we have random inspections. I don't know if the fact that we had a lot of violations here was a factor in scheduling that. Well, actually, this audit goes back to September, I think, so I doubt that our most recent notice of violation actually triggered that. Do you have anything to add about that, Lisa? Okay. So it may have just been one of those random audits.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Yaz Amrani. I'm the Public Works Director for County of Monterey, and I was wondering if I could be given just a couple minutes to give you an update to the recent update that you just heard about
sure.
the
Go ahead.
The report.
Oops.
As you were told, we had a first reading on March 2nd, and we adopted our storm water ordinance on March 16th, which was on Tuesday. I just wanted to give you a quick update because we understand that we're behind schedule in terms of the adoption, but I wanted to kind of give you some of the extenuating circumstances that might, hopefully put your mind at ease and put the staff's mind at ease in terms of our commitment to compliance with the stormwater ordinance. And this is an internal issue, of course, within Monterey County, but the Public Works Department took over the stormwater management program in July 1st, 2009, from our Water Resources Agency. So we took it over on July 1st, and basically I've worked very closely with our county council and other stakeholders to now move this ordinance to adoption, and we're going to move forward and continue working very aggressively to catch up on anything else that we need to do working with the Central Coast staff. So, again, I just wanted to bring to your attention the extenuating circumstances, even though it's an internal matter, but it's not a reflection that this is going to be a we're taking this matter lightly or we're not looking at this very aggressively. We are moving it very closely, and now that it's under our department, basically, we've taken all actions possible, including adding additional resources and personnel to make sure that we're in compliance as we move forward. So
what's the next step then? The ordinance has been adopted.
Yes.
And is it ready for implementation?
Yes, it is ready for implementation. In fact, we are working closely with our other departments, such as environmental health, our building department. We have the enforcement measures already in place as part of the previously adopted ordinance that we had under code enforcement. So we're aggressively moving forward to address any other issues that we have that working with the staff again at Central Coast and our program manager.
Thank you.
I have a question
sure.
actually. So until July of 2009, it was the responsibility, was that the Monterey County Water Resources Agency?
That is correct.
And they're the ones who didn't do anything with it at that point?
Well, I'll just...
You may not characterize it that way, but...
I'll plead the fifth.
They were having difficulty getting it out the door. Okay, I just wanted to make sure
yeah.
I had the right agency. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Could you please fill out a card so we have your contact information?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. So I have some other items to discuss. We might as well go to this card, however, Mr. Chair. For this item.
Okay. Mr. Shemek?
This has more to do with maybe stuff that will be discussed further. I'm not sure. But first of all, I do want to thank the County of Monterey for stepping forward and passing that ordinance. That was one of the complaints that we've consistently brought up to you guys. And frankly, I'm really happy to be able to stand up here and occasionally say thank you to people. So it happened. It's great. I'd like to bring your attention to page 2 of the Executive Officer's Report in the table of water quality certification applications. We are having some heartburn over the first item on that list, Monterey County Water Resources Agency, Salinas River Lagoon Fisheries Enhancement Project. That's a 401 cert where the Monterey County Water Resources Agency has said that they have a mitigated neg deck on the project, and they have not certified that mitigated neg deck. And so it's in front of it, the public comment period for your agency has come and passed, But yet the Monterey County Water Resources Agency hasn't responded to the questions that the environmental community has on the mitigated neg deck. And so it's this really awkward situation. And we don't know, frankly, we don't know how to deal with it because we've been told that the comment period has now come and gone. But we've also been told that, of course, if we have additional comments, they'll be considered. But, you know, you get into that kind of loosey-goosey phase where you don't know where you stand when you're a member of the public trying to comment on something. So I just want to bring it to your attention that it's a 401 cert. It is in this kind of limbo phase where we don't really know where it is. We don't really know what's happening. But you do not have a certified mitigated neg deck. So you have no certified environmental document, but yet it's been submitted to you for certification. Does anyone have any questions on what I just said? Because it is a confusing issue. That's it.
No, I'm curious. Maybe our attorney shed some light on.
Well, the regional board cannot act on a 401 certification until there's a final CEQA document. So the fact that there's a application to the regional board will not result in any action until that CEQA document is complete and final.
So the question is will the public have the opportunity to comment? In other words, we're being told, well, of course, but the comment period has come and gone.
And you're talking about the comment period on the CEQA document?
On the 401 cert.
Okay, so the regional board had their 20 days of
right,
comment.
And so that came and gone, but in reality, you don't have a certified document.
Right. Well, that's very frequently happens that the comment period for the 401 cert and the CEQA document aren't in sync. So if you commented on the 401 cert, then your comments will be taken into consideration.
I guess my point is that we had so many questions on the CEQA document that are relevant to what our comments might be on the 401 cert. In other words, this is a mitigated neg deck. They're essentially saying, yeah, there's not much going on, and so there's no thorough environmental document to really.
Well,
look
I would
at.
Suggest that you talk to the staff about that,
right?
And about whether they want to allow additional comments, because if it's not final, they can't issue it. So.
Right. So, all right. Thank you.
Sooner the better.
What's
the sooner the better?
We have talked to staff, but again, my point is right. That the comment period's gone.
Right.
So we're being told that we can make additional comments, but it gets into that kind of gray area that will those comments be taken into account?
Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Okay. You know, with stormwater, the question kind of I had generally is how are we doing with audits and review of annual reports? And some feedback before the next board meeting staff has been doing with.
Well, or maybe since we're going to be providing more information on this, maybe in concert with that.
That would be fine.
So maybe in addition to this, more of an overview of
right.
stormwater review.
Yeah. Well, all of them in terms of, you know, have all the phase twos been issued? I don't
status.
Know.
Status.
Yeah, what's the status of them? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know of those that have been issued, how many annual reports has staff been able to really go through kind of with a fine-tooth comb? And, you know, have they issued any notices of violation? Kind of what's the fallout from their review?
Right.
The board has kind of backed off putting, giving staff, you know, more to do in terms of, you know, reporting to us, you know, with these annual reviews, which we were doing at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And with some of the coastal swamps, I know that the board has been very interested in keeping on top of the swamps that have been issued to make sure that things are being carried out as the dischargers said that they would be in their plans.
Right. Yeah, and my information might be a little dated, but it seems to me that last time that I was in on a discussion of this in our office, we had decided to take the tact of, rather than having detailed audit level reviews of annual reports, it made based on what we found from doing that, it made more sense to be more strategic with targeting certain areas in the annual reports and looking for the areas that seem to be potentially more problematic. So, I mean, we can update you on whether that's still current and how that's been going at the next one. And it's easy to provide a tabulation of phase two status. And actually, I had made a note to myself this morning to provide an update for you on the so-called joint effort for hydro modification control criteria development to let you know how that's going, because that affects virtually all the municipalities. Well, it affects all the municipalities, but we have like a 95% sign-up rate. Good. To participate in this so-called joint effort to do that on a joint basis rather than individually.
Okay.
So I had already noted that we need to provide you an update on that.
Okay. And then back to the joint audit with US EPA. How does that happen, that EPA wants to do a joint audit of particular swamps? Is that?
Well, like I said, we don't know what the genesis was of that, what triggered it, but it is typical for us to have sometimes joint inspections, sometimes joint audits with EPA on the programs where we're implementing a federal permit.
Okay. And have they picked other swamps within our region to do any?
We had other EPA audits for the stormwater program.
For stormwater.
Lisa McCann, Environmental Program Manager. US EPA is available to us to provide audits for MPDS permits in general, and we work with them to prioritize which ones. So it's partly about time. Monterey Regional has had their Phase 2 permit for longer than some of our other, most of our municipalities. And then there were also some targeted areas that staff had identified specifically with the city of Monterey and their construction, post-construction arena, which is in the that's discussed in the EO report. So that we prioritized that to be one of the audits that US EPA provided staff resources to help us conduct.
Okay. So that was a swamp that staff targeted as being important enough to bring EPA in.
Right.
Yeah. Any others that staff has identified?
Specifically, are you asking specifically for US EPA audits?
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
I'd have to ask staff about that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Could we get some air in here? Is it possible?
Want to breathe?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, once in a while.
You control the HVAC system from your computer there? Can you see about that? Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Fran.
Fran Spivey-Weber, State Water Board. One thing, I can't believe I forgot this. In my report, it's because it's been delayed so long, but the once-through cooling policy, honestly, is going to, I think it is being posted publicly today, and it is to be scheduled for our May 4th board meeting for adoption. And I looked at it yesterday, read it through, and it has it's somewhat different from what you saw in November. It does have a special section for the nuclear facilities, which you have one, and then for you have one the Dynegy plant at Moss Landing. Yes, that's in a special category as well. And so there's some changes to both of those sections that you should pay attention to. But as I say, I think it should be posted today, and then we will act on it May 4th. And then hopefully it will be over in terms of the policy. And there is a role for regional boards in terms of your issuing the permit. There will be compliance dates in the in this draft policy. And again, the nuclear facilities have a special category. They're turning in a report before any kind of compliance date is put in, if there is one. And then you'll be continued, the regional board will be continuing to work with the power plants in your area on the science and the science reports on impingement and entrainment that you've worked with them on in the past. So there won't be any, at least in the draft, it's it keeps that responsibility at the regional board level. So, and I think it will stay, but we'll see. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm still in the middle of the EO report.
Go ahead.
Just, I thought we ought to go to this because it related to
right.
previous part of the report.
Okay.
Okay, so moving on then. On page 5, as usual, we have a little blurb about presentations and training, although I should note that in addition to what's listed here, we had... thanks to state board staff coming down to our office, they provided a couple of training sessions, I think it was just last week, one on presentations and one on media, dealing with the media and how to be more effective with the media. So Judy Pannington and Rukeyser and Dave Klagern came down. So we appreciate state board staff providing that. The next section there is about the budget status, and board member Spivey Weber already mentioned that a bit. One of the things that's a little bit different way of looking at it here is I pointed out that with the further reduction in salary savings, we've always had a target of 5% salary savings, which means our true spending cap, if you will, is actually 95% of the budget on an ongoing basis, which is really just a reflection of the fact that it's has always been not realistic to be completely staffed up at any given time with turnover. So we've always had that 5% cut target, if you will. We now have, with the governor's proposal for the 10-11 budget, another 5% salary reduction. We have the 5% pay cut proposed by the governor for employees, and then a like amount, says 5% more payment into the retirement system, which is means that employees pay more and the state pays less. Anyway, you add all that up and it actually ends up being a 20% reduction in terms of our state water board's budget, 20% less than the budget from previous years. We have about a 9% vacancy rate now, and again, Fran, you addressed the idea of meeting the 10% salary savings through vacancies and normal attrition, but it will mean, as you said, a different kind of management of those vacancies and not filling the vacancies as they come due. So as of right now, that's already we already see some of that in effect with a 9% vacancy rate, and of course we're not into the new fiscal year yet, so the administrative folks at the state board think we'll be okay as far as being able to meet that 10% salary savings figure. Well, the way that the water boards are looking at it and the way the budget is actually allocated is the water boards as a whole. So for example, in our region, we were actually in the hole, if you will, and that we owed some positions. We didn't have as much attrition as other boards. So as the budget was cut, our attrition rate didn't keep up with it, basically. We are now out of the red, if you will, and I think we have, was it 0.3 or something like that, vacancies in the black, but nowhere near the 10%. But other organizations, Region 4, I think Region 4 is Los Angeles, Central Valley region, Region 5, which is the biggest region, and then and the state board have significantly higher vacancy rates than that. and they're bigger organizations, so that it ends up being a grand total of about 9%, with the idea that we should be able to make it to 10%. But what it means is that, and you again, you alluded to this, is that we as an organization, if we get vacancies, we're not going to be able to fill them. And it's only those organizations that are really into the black beyond that 10% salary savings that can even consider filling vacancies. Okay, any more questions on the budget? The next topic here says board outreach, and you recall that we sent out, call it Watershed Agencies letter, that that you board members signed at the December meeting. Part of the outgrowth of that is that the chair and I are planning on meeting with the Santa Barbara Urban Creeks Council next month in Santa Barbara, and Tom O'Malley, board member Tom O'Malley, has asked me to address the city council of the city of Atascadero. I think that's scheduled, well, that's not scheduled yet, but we're looking at next month. The Santa Clara Valley Water District also responded to that letter and wanted to get together with us. So board member David Hodgen was kind enough to volunteer to be the board representative for that meeting, which we do have scheduled. And it's coming up. What is it? March 29th? March 29th in San Jose. And actually, we're going to have a two-part meeting where we'll have a board level meeting with apparently a couple of board members from the Water District, and then a second staff level meeting. We had enough interest in that that they said all of their board members were interested in attending, but then that triggered public notice requirements and a formal district meeting, and we kind of scaled it back to where it'll be a little more informal setting, which hopefully will be more productive. Let's see, and then speaking of board member Hodgen, I'm scheduled to speak with the AQUA group, the Association of California Water Agencies, first part of April, April 11th, down in Lompoc, and that's in association with a tour of water facilities at the Vandenberg Air Force Base. So I imagine we'll have a similar message down there. So that's a good opportunity with the water agencies. Okay, and then any questions on board outreach? Next item, it says emerging contaminants. And I've got a set of PowerPoint if someone would mind going to that. You know, it actually might work better if I run that, so maybe I'll speak from down there if that's okay.
I'm curious.
Oh, I can use that? Oh, that's good.
Roger, I'm just curious whether the rest of the board saw this article that's attached. Okay. You didn't see this?
No.
Last part of the Yale report. Worth reading. It's about...
I'll speak about it.
Okay.
Harvey's going to fire up on the screen here. So, as the chair said, we sent out this article, which is from the L.A. Daily Journal, thank you, and it deals with this issue, which is not exactly a new issue. All it's, they're called emerging contaminants. We don't have that up here yet. Whoops, that's not it. Do we hit display current up here? While he's trying to put that on our screens, so this article from the journal, the Daily Journal, talks about this topic, which, of course, we have been doing battle with and trying to get a handle on it, of emerging contaminants, which includes pharmaceuticals. That's not the full range of what they call emerging contaminants. There's the article, and it is attached to the executive officer's report in here. And one of the things that it points out, you see the headline, something can be done, and basically this author zeroes in on a couple facilities that have the potential for increased control, and those are hospice, what happens with hospice care, with end-of-life care, and inevitably there are unused drugs as a result of that, and then also healthcare facilities. So, drugs down the drain. I was going for alliteration. And as I said, the LA Daily Journal article that our chair provided prompted this discussion to see if there's something more that we could be doing as a regional board. One of the things that the article starts out with is that it points out that most of the drugs that actually end up in the sewer system come from us, in that we don't metabolize all the drugs that, hopefully those are prescription drugs, that we take, and they actually just pass right through our bodies. So the biggest volume of these emerging contaminants, the pharmaceuticals that end up in the sewer systems and then consequently pass through treatment plants and end up in whatever the receiving water is of the treatment plant, actually is just from us not metabolizing those drugs. And, of course, that's a difficult problem to deal with. But this article points out that the sources with better control potential are, as I said, hospice practices and then healthcare facilities of all kinds. So for the first category of residential, now not talking about what passes through our bodies, but what residents might just toss down the drain because they're out of date or they're mad about their drugs or something. And we have a program to deal with that, which is really an education outreach program. With hospice care, of course, a lot of people are familiar with the great work that hospice does and the assistance that they provide for families, but they provide that in both residential settings as well as in sometimes care facilities, healthcare facilities of various kinds. Hospice workers will go into wherever the patients are and wherever the families are having to care for their family members. So with hospice, you're really talking about both residential and healthcare facilities. And then larger healthcare facilities themselves are a source, potential source. Of course, there are different ways of disposing of these drugs so that they don't go down the drain. Okay. So for residential, backing up, it says recycle. That's a reminder that the state board, I think it was about a year ago, adopted the recycled water policy. And my understanding is that because of the fact that by the very nature of recycling, there's a potential for more of these drugs to be concentrated in certain areas with recycled wastewater. That was one of the reasons for coming up with the Blue Ribbon Task Force to say, okay, how do we deal with this issue vis-a-vis recycling? But I anticipate that the recommendations may be applicable beyond just recycling programs. And as Fran pointed out, that report, did you mention that's going to be out this spring? Oh, last night you did. Okay. Okay. And that's that Blue Ribbon panel. Well, it says here spring report. I was guessing a little bit. And then as far as residential, here's a shot of our website, and this is a link directly from the front page of our website. So for residences, we provide this kind of information, which actually Carol Hewitt put together. She gathered the information from other municipalities and agencies that have provided this kind of detail on the proper method of household medication disposal. And Carol put together the web page and loaded up on our website. So thanks very much for doing that, Carol. This was that a couple years ago you did that? It's been a while anyway. I think couple years ago. And so that's been available on our website for that period of time. Now for, what am I pointing at? There we go. Okay, so for hospice, like I said, that you have both the residences as well as, in some cases, could be long-term care facilities and that sort of thing. So I contacted in San Luis Obispo, simply because they were local, the local hospice executive director, and she confirmed that they do have guidelines for safe disposal, and in fact, with the local hospice in San Luis Obispo, they do not dump drugs down the drain. The article, I think, mentions that it is a practice, and I've verified from talking with other people throughout the state that this is an ongoing practice with some of the hospices, that the hospice nurses will actually take the drugs, inventory them, and then with a witness, say, from the family, put them down the drain, and it's kind of like notarizing that, and not a formal notary, but documenting with a witness that they have disposed of these drugs properly so they don't end up in the wrong hands. So it's a way of assuring that they don't get used for bad purposes, but of course it's contrary to the idea of keeping those contaminants out of the water system because they ultimately do end up in our waters. But the local hospice has guidelines that from Hospice California that they follow that provide for safe disposal, and they've abandoned that practice of putting drugs down the drain years ago. So I was able to find that out, and my thought was that it might be a good idea to write a letter to both California Hospice and National Hospice. I checked out their information and got their contact information and actually drafted a letter for Dorothy Rice's consideration for signing. And Dorothy's gone right now, but Tom Howard has that. And my idea was that maybe USEPA, Alexis Strauss, could sign that as well. And that's prompted some discussion with Alexis Strauss on EPA's role with pharmaceuticals. And it looks like we're, in fact, I think Nancy Aquino now is lining up a meeting that will include you with Alexis Strauss to discuss this with EPA.
How about the other hospices within the Central Coast region?
I didn't call anyone besides the local one. I did learn, though, that the California Hospice Organization and the National Hospice Organization, and I included, where did I include that? Anyway, I have a copy of their, it's in the letter, that's it. Anyway, I have language that says that they will provide a policy for safe disposal of drugs.
All of their hospices?
Right, so that would cover all the hospices. Okay. But it sounds like there's a holdover, in terms of implementing that policy, a holdover to the old way of having a witness that to help inventory and document that they've put the drugs down the drain. That's why I thought maybe a letter would help, just to say, you've got this policy, maybe it'd be a good idea to reinforce it. It wouldn't be a new policy.
Right.
Okay, so that's where we stand with the hospice situation. And as far as the healthcare facilities themselves, we've kind of opened a can of worms with that one. But I'm sure there are healthcare facilities that are disposing of these in a way that they don't end up in the sewer system. But in terms of how we would enforce that or ensure that that's happening, that's where we've gotten into the worms a little bit. So the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, the federal act, has requirements that could regulate the disposal of pharmaceuticals. And this article implies that US EPA is not enforcing the RCRA requirements. As you might guess, EPA has a different take on that. And Francis McChesney did a little snooping, and it turns out the Department of Toxic Substances Control is actually the state agency responsible for enforcing RCRA, and then there's some responsibility from the Department of Public Health, depending on the type of, if it's a medical waste. So we're looking into that, but it's, so I mentioned California Department of Toxic Substances Control, DPH, the Department of Public Health, as having a role depending on the type of waste. One of the things we're looking at is our more traditional route would be pretreatment requirements, because the role of pretreatment is to keep bad stuff, say, typically from industries, but keep the bad stuff out of the sewer system that might pass through that the treatment plant can't handle, and that's the pass-through term, and end up in the environment. That's the idea of pretreatment. But traditionally, pretreatment requirements have not addressed pharmaceuticals or these emerging contaminants. And one of the main reasons is that the municipality, when they have a pretreatment program, and that's typically for the either the larger facilities or those that have a risk from contaminants that would pass through their system, what they target, and you can understand why this would be the case, is any kind of a contaminant that might cause them to violate their permit limits. Well, we don't have limits for these pharmaceuticals. They're very hard to, they're expensive to test for. They're very minute quantities, but you can test for them. It just costs a lot of money. But then there's a huge number of them, and that's one of the reasons for the Blue Ribbon Task Force to try to deal with that. SCWRP, the Southern California Water Research Project, has provided a report to the Blue Ribbon Panel with their recommendations in term, mostly geared towards monitoring, what's the best bets to have in terms of sort of indicator constituents for monitoring. So they have, they've done a lot of work with that. But anyway, I guess it's safe to say we're investigating whether we can use our authority through pretreatment requirements to maybe assist with this issue. I think that's where we stand at the moment. And like I said, one of the issues is permit limits. So another angle would be to use the anti-degradation policy as a way of getting at this, and as opposed to having strict permit limits. So that's another thing we're looking into. So that's all the information I have. It kind of gives you an idea of where we are at the moment with this issue.
Thank you.
I'd like to add to that. I talked with a care facility owner who's been in the business about 20 years about drug disposal, and she said that those facilities that attend the professional workshops and so forth for their industry are regularly hit with this issue. It's something that's in the forefront. She readily admitted that there are a lot of minor facilities that don't normally go to these workshops, but there are written guidelines that are handed out to them at the workshops, and that most of the facilities that she's familiar with have a contract with a local pharmaceutical supplier from which they get the drugs in the first place. And normally that material is delivered to their facility. And when the driver goes back to the pharmacy again, he takes the bag of all the items to be disposed of back to the pharmacy. And so that's the way they handle it. They just they have this interchange going all the time.
What kind of facility?
What kind of facility?
Did you speak with?
This particular one's an Alzheimer's facility. It's run by somebody who always attends these workshops and is very active in their various associations. And so I was trying to get a feeling for how they think about it and what they're trying to do. And so I felt it was encouraging that they think they have a procedure that works.
Right. Is it something that's mandatory?
I don't know that it's mandatory. I think that that's what their best practices are, what they're being told the best practices are. And they do have a written procedure.
With the local hospice that I mentioned talking to, they have a agreement with a local pharmacy for taking care of these drugs.
Okay.
I can just add that on that particular issue, that's where the Department of Public Health comes in, because they are, if it's a medical waste, they manage the management of medical waste, including pharmaceuticals, unused ones, and both small and large generators or users of those kinds of waste have to have a medical waste management plan. So it sounds like the Alzheimer facility probably has one of those medical waste management plans, and that's what they have to demonstrate what they're doing with the materials, which also is covered by a lot of these kinds of things are regulated by the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, which overlays on top of this dealing with controlled substances. But the bottom line is that for our purposes, if it's a hazardous waste, it's illegal to discharge it into the sewer. But the way these kind of wastes are regulated, how they're not many of them are defined as hazardous waste, and then there's an exemption from, even if they are hazardous waste, from the definition of hazardous waste if they're a small facility, so, or a house or the hospice care facilities, and small businesses like doctor's offices or veterinarians and whatnot are small generators, and so even if they have a waste that's classified as a hazardous waste, it's exempt as that classification. And then the information that generally is provided is that it's legal to then put that waste in the sewer or in a landfill, but not recommended to put it in the sewer. So, but in terms of legality, it's currently legal to do that from those small facilities, but from large facilities, it wouldn't be legal.
Does anyone know when these unused drugs are turned into the pharmacies, what does the pharmacy do with it? I mean, do they then put them down the sink?
Well, then I think that's where they would fit into having to have the medical waste management plan and have to manage them according
to
their plan.
Yeah.
But the problem is, so for example, there's a list. In order to be a hazardous waste, there's two ways it can be a hazardous waste. It's a federal hazardous waste, and that's either it's a listed waste or it meets certain criteria. So one of the criteria is toxicity, so the waste will be tested to see if it passes a fish toxicity test. And if it fails the test, in other words, it's toxic, then it would be considered a hazardous waste. The other way it could be a hazard, those are federal hazardous waste, and then another way is it could be a California-only hazardous waste, and so things that aren't hazardous waste under federal law could be hazardous waste under state law. So if it's hazardous, it has to be managed in a certain way. But here's some list of things that are not considered hazardous, and there include insulin, oxytocin, heparin, lidocaine, magnesium sulfate, and some of them I can't pronounce, so I'm not saying them. milk of magnesia, mylanta, things like that are not hazardous waste. And if they're not hazardous waste, then there could be medical waste. And if they're medical waste, then they have to be disposed of by incineration. So it basically depends on how they're classified, what happens to them. And if they're not medical waste or hazardous waste, then they can be disposed of, like I said, down the sewer or in the garbage. Some examples of things that are hazardous waste would be kinds of medications that have metals in them, like mercury, or is barium a metal? Barium. Those would be hazardous. So some things would be hazardous, but not a lot.
I went back to our webpage, and if you look at number 4 down there, it's very small print on here. But anyway, it points out that there are pharmacies that have a take-back program. So they have some kind of, I don't know if it's a certification, but they're supposed to accept those drugs and then dispose of them properly. With anything like this, there's room for abuse, of course, but
As part of our pretreatment program, can we ask our WWTPs to be including some kind of a flyer like this with their bills, monthly bills, or otherwise disseminate information like this?
Well, you said, can we ask them? We can ask them. I don't know if, as far as requiring them, we'd have to look into that. A lot of them do this already. Like I said, Carol actually just looked at a bunch of different websites that already have this kind of information to try to look for the best examples. So I know a lot of them have it already. I would say it's no problem asking them to do so.
Well, maybe I should ask, can we require it? that's...
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I'm still researching to see how to do that.
Let me jump in here just a little bit.
Sure.
The Recycled Water Policy Blue Ribbon Task Force is meeting. It will have a draft report, I'm told, in April. The final report would be out in June. There's going to be a follow-up effort of 1 year focused particularly on oceans and constituents of emerging concern. Once the policy is out, according to the DTSC, our state enforcement division for RCRA, they are going to be looking at this report, as will DPH. And I think at that point, which that's this summer, we will be have an opportunity to put together some plans, some work plans among the different agencies that have responsibility as to where we should focus our short-term effort, what kinds of things we need to be doing over the longer term, and what kinds of things we may not need to worry about. Part of the problem of this is it's so big and has so many moving parts that people get depressed when they start because it's just so much. And that was the reason for the Blue Ribbon Task Force. And they're supposed to come in with practical recommendations as to what we need to do now, what we need to study more, and what we don't need to worry about. So I'm looking forward to that report, as I'm sure you all are, and I'll make sure that that both Jeff and Roger and Francis are in the mix in terms of whatever we decide to do next. Thank you.
Good. Well, maybe we can just then kind of follow up status report once that report is released, and then we can
see what. And like I said, we're getting this meeting scheduled that hopefully you can participate in with EPA's Alexis Strauss.
My interest in this is simply to make sure that as an agency we're doing what we should be doing to make sure that we're doing our responsibility to keep things like this out of public waters, out of the ocean, out of rivers, make sure that we're doing our role in educating the public and making sure that the discharge and release of these substances is minimized. Mm-hmm. So that's my interest.
I'm certainly with you on that. I just hope that, and I was encouraged by Ms. Francis Spivey Weber's comments, that what is already being done and what other agencies are responsible for is being taken into consideration. I worry that we are not aware of everything that's going on out there, and we may add our own layer of problems when it really isn't necessary.
Sure, I wouldn't worry about that. Roger and I actually went to a WQCC. I don't know if you were there, Dave, down in the, was it the Santa Ana region?
Yeah, Chino.
Chino, where we did get a briefing that this report and task force was underway. And they're really up to date on doing, I think they have reverse osmosis. Did we see that in some of those facilities down there where they're trying to address some of these issues because they're trying to reclaim as much wastewater as possible, reinject it into the ground to recharge as potential useful water. So they're looking at things like this. So don't worry, I wasn't going to appoint you to a special board task force to come up with what we should be doing here, trying to reinvent anything.
And speaking of other agencies, one that I
do want to put John on that special task force.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned all the agencies that are involved. I meant to mention one other that's involved that was actually brought up by Alexis Strauss of USEPA, and that's the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA. And, of course, their slant is to make sure that the drugs do not end up in the wrong hands. They're probably not as concerned about environmental protection, but they're another, it's another constraint.
So one last thought on this. My grandmother passed away about 4 or 5 years ago, and I was present when the hospice worker came in, and she immediately, once, I mean, this was within about an hour of her passing, and she was still in the house with us, went around and said, I want all her medications, all her drugs. And she gathered them all together, and she made me be the witness, and they went down the drain. Now, at the time, that property has a septic tank, and I wasn't all that alarmed about what I was participating in, but it immediately dawned on me, this is going on throughout, you know, my area, which is the city of Santa Barbara and Goleta, because that's how this hospice operates. So intuitively, I knew this is not really a good thing, but it's taken this much time for maybe something to come to a head where we can try to get our hands on it. So some hospices are doing the right thing, and others just need to be brought up to speed, I think. All right. Anything else, Roger, for the EO report?
Yeah, but I think it's something that would be better to wait until we take care of the other business.
Okay. All right. Should we take a break before we go to the TMDL item? So that's agenda item 12 is immediately next.